Hey, we're 20 minutes away from 5 o'clock. It is downtown. Quick little Red Sox note. Pablo Sandoval placed on the disabled list with a quote-unquote shoulder injury.
Oh. All right, Pete Abraham. We're going to let it be a shoulder injury
then.
There
you go. Little break. He'll be fine here. It is time for Sports Lit 101 on Downtown. We do it every Wednesday. Bruce Pratt joining us in studio and on the phone line, the author of a book that we've talked about several times here on the show, and we're thrilled to have him with us. C. Richard King joins us. Rich, thanks so much for being on the show with us this afternoon.
Hey, my pleasure.
This remarkable book about that Washington pro football team, a historical perspective on the whole thing, the evolution of the team, as well as the name and the usage of that word. And I'm curious, too, about the connection between a guy who got this team started, George Preston Marshall, and current owner Daniel Snyder. Is there something that those two have in common?
Well, I think they both like money. They both are very invested in the brand and trying to grow the brand. I'm trying to think what else they might have in common beyond that. That's the two things that come to mind.
Well, and also it would seem perhaps a stubborn unwillingness to admit they were wrong.
Oh, yes, this is very true, because George Preston Marshall, of course, was resistant to integrating his football team until federal government pressured him to do so, and now Daniel Snyder's resistant to changing the name, and it may take pressure from local and federal government to encourage him to do so. I mean, there's some talk that he might be willing to change the name, or there are at least rumors he might be willing to change the name if he got a stadium deal. So, you know, it's similar dynamic there in terms of ownership and their recalcitrance to change.
Hi, Rich, this is Bruce. One of the things that struck me as so incredible about your book is the cover, which we can't go into great detail, but you make a really interesting point that the name of the Washington Redskins football team is not a word we would use in addressing another human being, and yet it lives on, whereas words that have long left our general lexicon in other ways, that it's very different. Can you speak a little bit to that and a little bit about the erroneous notion that it's okay to use humans as mascots?
Yeah. An important difference between Native Americans and other racial and ethnic groups in the United States is they're demographically small. Two, they have a limited amount of political and economic power. They're largely invisible as people, and because of those combination of factors, it's difficult for them to sort of be recognized as people. And so, a lot of Americans think of the term not as a slur first and foremost, but simply as a reference to an imaginary thing. Not unlike they might say, you know, Indians or leprechauns. And so this imaginary thing is something that they have a kind of ownership over that other ethnic groups have really successfully sort of pushed back and said, hey, you don't own us, and you don't own the language that is used to describe us. And I think African Americans are a really good example of this. You know, and the N-word might be the equivalent to the R-word, and of course we don't use the N-word in polite conversation, and we wouldn't use it in this current age, as a brand or branding tool. So that's an important kind of difference. Why it is that people think that they can use this one set of people to sort of represent their sports teams, I think has to do with the nature of sports, which is very much about masculinity and combat and conflict, all of which are embodied in the kinds of images that we create of Native Americans in the sporting context. And all of these images arise at a moment right after really we sort of, I guess we would say, conquered Native Americans, right? And so it's sort of like this victorious moment of claiming a trophy. And then that trophy comes to be something that is a totem for good luck. So why is it appropriate? Is we're really creating this mythical false image And in doing so, we're really sort of projecting what we want them to be rather than what they are. And that really denies them any capacity to be equal or be included or really be recognized as human.
We're talking with author C. Richard King here on Downtown. We fought and continue to fight this battle in Maine. There is just one high school left in the state that uses Indians as their mascot and their nickname. And often the argument of those who want to keep that name is that it honors the Native American people. Why is that a faulty argument?
Well, the notion of honor is faulty for at least two reasons. One, it rests on a notion that what you're doing is positive, and really the person who's arbitrating or judging what is positive in that gesture is the person who's extending the gesture. So if I'm saying, hey, I'm honoring you, I'm the one who in that context, like this context, is saying, you know, I'm doing something positive. It's also faulty because it suggests that what matters in how messages or symbols are received is what I intend, right? I intend to honor you. I intend for this to be positive, right? And both of those really neglect the way that American Indians or others might receive your action or your symbol, right? And so you might want it to be positive, or you might mean for it to be honorific, but the way that it is actually received or how it impacts audiences and individuals is very different. So in this context, something that's meant to honor or is intended to be positive actually can have the consequence of being very hurtful and very negative. Psychological studies show that mascots and similar kinds of images which are intended to be positive actually have negative and hurtful consequences for American Indian youth in terms of how they think about themselves, their futures, and their communities. Right? So it may be that you want to honor someone or you want to do something good, but when it's hurting them or it's having negative consequences, honor is probably not the right frame to be thinking of your action or your representation.
So as we try and figure out what to do, is money the only thing that will get the attention of people like Daniel Snyder?
Well, I mean, it's very complicated. I mean, I think Snyder's tied into the team as an owner who wants to make money, who wants his brand to be profitable. I think he's also tied into the team as a lifelong fan whose connection is very sentimental and is very much about a personal bond that he has with his own past and with his father and his community. And so I think the money might be part of it, but clearly I think it's more complex than that. And I think that things like education, raising awareness and sensitivity, giving people an opportunity to develop empathy towards Native Americans, hearing from Native Americans, interacting with Native Americans, all of these things can go, I think, a long way towards changing how individuals, how communities, and perhaps even how owners feel about sports mascots. I mean, this is something I think has made a big difference in local communities, is often working with and interacting with tribes and tribal members.
Now, if we were in Canada, we wouldn't be facing this. I cannot imagine a Canadian Aboriginal people I think they would have enough clout with all the problems there are in Canada. What would be the best approach, in your opinion, we as people could take in the country to pressure the franchise to change their name?
Well, I guess I would advocate sort of a multi-prong approach. I mean, I think that one thing that fans can do and citizens can do is to communicate with policymakers and lawmakers and indicate that, you know, this is problematic. This is something that they would like to see their elected officials address and engage, that this really is a civil rights issue because it's about public accommodation and whether people can enjoy the same kinds of opportunities and experiences that their friends and neighbors and fellow citizens do. I think it's something that managers and management of sporting facilities should be sort of contacted to address. Because if somebody shows up to a game in a headdress, right, that could be read, as insulting or intimidating or mocking, right? Which again, I don't think that's what sporting facilities really want. I believe reaching out to and, if necessary, boycotting merchandise or even media might be another way that fans could really effectively say, "Hey, I like the NFL. I like the team in Washington. I don't like this mascot, right? And it needs to change." And I really think that if fans raise their voices and change their behavior, the NFL will follow suit. I think that one of the things that has aided the team and the NFL up to this point has been that their arguments have been taken at face value, and most fans don't see why it should matter to them. And when it does begin to matter to the fan base and they begin to push back, I really think that that's when change will begin to manifest itself.
Well, terrific research on the book, a wonderful piece of writing, and you've made the most compelling case that I've certainly read. The book entitled, and we'll say it for the purpose of the title, Redskins, Insult and Brand. C. Richard King, thank you so much for your work, and thanks for being with us here this afternoon.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.